This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last night, President George W. Bush and Senator John F. Kerry faced off in Tempe, Arizona, for their third and final presidential debate, this one on domestic issues. Over the course of 90 minutes, both candidates had time to work in carefully prepared points. Here, for example, in response to a question about the minimum wage, Senator Kerry argued that the president's opposition to an increase in the minimum wage hurts women.
The president has denied 9.2 million women, $3,800 a year, but he doesn't hesitate to fight for $136,000 to a millionaire. 1% of America got $89 billion last year in a tax cut. But people working hard, playing by the rules, trying to take care of their kids, family values that we're supposed to value so much in America. I'm tired of politicians who talk about family values and don't value families. What we need to do is raise the minimum wage. We also need to hold on to equal pay. Women work for 76 cents on the dollar for the same work that men do. That's not right in America. And we had an initiative that we were working on to raise women's pay. They've cut it off. They've stopped it. They don't enforce these kinds of things.
Then, answering a question about health care, President Bush said his opponent's proposal amounted to a government-run plan.
We have a fundamental difference of opinion. I think government-run health will lead to poor quality health, will lead to rationing, will lead to less choice. Once a health care program ends up in a line item in the federal government budget, it leads to more controls. And just look at other countries that have tried to have federally controlled health care. They have poor quality health care. Our health care system is the envy of the world because we believe in making sure that the decisions are made by doctors and patients, not by officials in the nation's capital.
Along with the two-party conventions, presidential debates are now established as major events in the campaign. Most experts agree that the nationally broadcast matchups do affect the race. How exactly is a little hard to figure out. In just a moment, we'll talk with David Broder of The Washington Post and our own Ron Elving about what happened last night. Later, we'll bring in Kathleen Hall Jamieson at the Annenberg Center. And we want to hear from you. What worked and what didn't? Did you learn anything important about the candidate you support? Did you learn anything new? What effect do you think the debates are having on the election? And no spin, please. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now to talk about the impact of the debates are Ron Elving, NPR's Washington, senior Washington editor. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Ron, always good to have you.
Good to be here, Neil.
And David Broder, reporter and columnist for The Washington Post, is with us from the studios at The Washington Post, and good to have you on the program.
Good to be with you, Neil.
Let me ask you both about last night's debate. Those clips we just played sounded like the candidates were appealing to their base, not after the relatively small number of undecided voters out there. David Broder, do you agree?
I think that's inevitable when you're dealing with the domestic and social issues, because these are traditional dividing lines between Democrats and Republicans. It's not like the war in Iraq, which scrambles the party lines and forces people to think in different and new ways. These are issues that have been debated over the decades, and we saw on both sides, I think, they're taking very traditional postures on those issues.
Mm-hmm. Ron?
Indeed, I thought that it was remarkable the degree to which President Bush had adopted a new line of central attack on Senator Kerry. He kept calling him a liberal. He used the term many, many times. He contrasted Kerry with his fellow Democratic senator, much better known in the public in general, Teddy Kennedy from Massachusetts, said by comparison Teddy Kennedy was the conservative senator from Massachusetts, made this point so often and dropped, I believe entirely, the usual line of attack, which was that Senator Kerry has been on every side of every issue and, in fact, doesn't know his own mind, has no principles, doesn't stand anywhere in particular, and is a flip-flopper.
Well, let's hear an example of that from President Bush. Here's a clip from last night's debate.
You know, there's a mainstream in American politics, and you sit right on the far left bank. As a matter of fact, your record is such that Ted Kennedy, your colleague, is the conservative senator from Massachusetts.
Just what Ron Elving was quoting there. David Broder, does the L word still carry the sting it used to?
It's not clear whether it will be overshadowed this time by the issues that they were talking about in the first two debates of Iraq and terrorism. But Ron, what I went back yesterday and reread the transcript of the final debate between President Bush, then Governor Bush, and then Vice President Al Gore. And you know what? It was exactly the same line of attack. Bush was calling Gore a liberal. So there's nothing new about this way of approaching things from the Republican side.
When we get to the domestic issues and when we get down to 20 days away from the election, they revert to a more classic line of attack as opposed to the more specific attack on Kerry personally or as an individual politician as being someone who could not take a side and always had to dance back and forth.
David, we know you talk to a lot of voters. Have they been watching these debates? How are they reacting?
They've been watching, and they, I think, overall, the debates have clearly played to Senator Kerry's advantage. First of all, because like all challengers, he's less known at the start of the debates than the incumbent that he's opposing. But secondly, because of his demeanor, his posture, and the fact that he has gone as long as he has now on stage with the President of the United States, without showing the slightest bit of nervousness, hesitation. In fact, in many people's scorecards, probably outpointed the president.
Ron, the polls all suggest that the voters are extremely engaged with this election. I think 90% of registered voters say that they're certain to vote this November. That may not happen. It probably won't. But nevertheless, as you look at the polls after the three debates, the instant polls, all of them seem to give Senator Kerry, the viewers thought Kerry had won. The third called it a draw last night. Kerry was declared the winner in most of the polls after the first two debates, too. Does that make a difference?
Oh, I think it clearly has made a difference. In fact, I think we've seen a marvelous illustration of why incumbent presidents traditionally were not inclined to debate their opponent. 1964, LBJ, Nixon in 72. They really couldn't see any reason why they would let their opponent in the ring with them. I think George W. Bush had enough of a lead in September, 5 to 10 points, pretty steady in most of the array of polls, that seemed to be holding. Kerry didn't seem to be able to buy a break and was receiving more and more criticism from all directions, including in his own party. All that changed on September 30th, and the momentum of that has continued through the 2 weeks. Whether you give Bush a draw in the second debate or call it 3-0 for Kerry, clearly it's changed the momentum of the race and brought it back into a deadlocked state.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are David Broder of The Washington Post and NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. And let's talk now with Chuck, who's calling from San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you very much. I thought the whole thing was kind of superficial, as one of your guests kind of alluded to earlier, that it was an awful lot of familiar sort of liberal conservative stuff. And I was real disappointed that there was not more in-depth discussion, or there wasn't any discussion of the environment, virtually no discussion of energy, and the discussion of homeland security was a lot more kind of familiar slogans and no discussion of the question on as regards homeland security that's been bothering me for a long time, which is what the heck does fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here mean? Seems to me that that just misunderstands the nature of the terrorist threat.
Mm-hmm. David Broder, Chuck is right. There were a lot of issues that really didn't get discussed in a lot of depth last night. Do people tune in, do you think? Are they concerned about issues or are they concerned about the manner in which the candidates present themselves?
Well, all year long we've had strong evidence that people are really concerned about issues and about the condition of the country and our engagements overseas. I think the overriding issues are probably still Iraq, terrorism, and the economy. And the problem that Bob Schieffer, who I have to say is a friend, so take it with a grain of salt.
If you missed the debate last night, it was, of course, the moderator, Bob Schieffer of CBS. Go ahead.
But I think the challenge that Bob faced, for which there's no easy solution, is that the agenda of separate issues under the heading domestic and social issues is so large that you either touch on them very briefly or not at all. And I think he did the best job he could, even with the 90-minute time limit.
And Ron Elving, to be fair again, the candidates go in with, we want to make these 8 points, and they're going to make them no matter what the question is.
John Kerry did take the opportunity in the midst of another answer to refer to a stewardship of the environment as one of the places where he thought faith might have application in policy. But no, there was never a direct question, and it was not one of the 8, as you suggest, points that either man came in really intent on talking about. The polls show people are very interested in this. It shows the polls show a clear advantage for Kerry on this issue, but neither man really thought that that was a place where he could earn dividends last night.
Didn't it seem that there were an awful lot of kind of apple pie issues and the same old hot button issues that politicians usually try and obfuscate, and they did again last night? And there could have been a lot more depth, it seemed to me, if the format or the questions had been a little different.
I think the format is constructed for short answers and not for a great deal of depth. I would tip my hat to Bob Schieffer for the extraordinary range of issues that were touched upon. But you're absolutely right. They did not get to all, and they did not get to them in the depth that you and I think many of the voters would prefer.
So Chuck, where do we get it directly from the candidates as opposed to through spokespeople and pundits and so on? I mean, I really want to know direct from the candidates some depth on some important issues.
Well, they do have websites.
I think the website is not an evasive answer that when the candidates refer to their websites, there is a mass of information and policy on both those websites.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Chuck. David Broder, these are the last, last night was the last scheduled debate. Is there anything between now and Election Day that would be, you know, at least predictably the possibility of a transformative event, something that could again change the dynamic?
Not predictably, but I think certainly a very live possibility. And I have been talking with voters, including some who are genuinely undecided and are waiting for some sort of a signal as to which way they ought to go from their own point of view. And I think that signal may very well come from an outside event, as probably more likely to be of an event than something that the candidates say or do in their own campaigning.
Ron, do you agree?
I have thought, and I think many people have thought for some while, that this is an election that would be determined by events. The debates were events. There are no other scheduled events. The debates have made a difference. We still have a little more than 2 weeks in which things can happen and then be broadly interpreted or have an emotional reaction in the public. I don't want to predict anything in particular, but I do think that there will be something between now and November 2nd that will make a difference.
In the 30 seconds we have left, David Broder, the viewership of these events, these debates, has been extraordinarily high this year. Is this a reflection, do you think, of how engaged people are, or are people really trying to learn something here?
It's a clear indication of how engaged people are. And I'm beginning to see signs now, not simply that voter registration is up, but in a number of states, the applications for absentee ballots are breaking all the records. We're going to have a very large election.
David Broder of The Washington Post, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Enjoyed it.
David Broder joined us from the studios of The Washington Post. Rod Elving will stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by Kathleen Hall Jamieson of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and continue taking your calls and emails. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about this year's presidential debate. Last night, both President Bush and Senator Kerry accused each other of errors of fact as well as judgment, and they were both right. Senator Kerry said that the president ignored the African-American leadership.
This president is the first president ever, I think, not to meet with the NAACP. This is a president who hasn't met with the Black Congressional Caucus. This is a president who has not met with the civil rights leadership of our country.
President Bush shot back that he had met with the Congressional Black Caucus at the White House, twice in fact, and earlier this summer he addressed the Urban League.
The thing I like about the National Urban League is you believe in the future of the African American community. You've got this great faith that the future is going to be better. And I share that. That's what I'm here to talk about. I believe the same thing.
When Senator Kerry quoted the president as saying that he didn't really think about Osama bin Laden very much, that he wasn't that concerned, the president denied it.
Gosh, I don't think I ever said I'm not worried about Osama bin Laden. That's kind of one of those exaggerations.
In fact, the president did say what John Kerry said he did twice.
I wouldn't necessarily say he's at the center of any command structure. And, you know, again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him. I know he is on the run. I was concerned about him when he had taken over a country.
We continue our conversation about the debates with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. And joining us now from her office in Philadelphia is Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at that university. Good to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
And let me begin with a fact check. How well did the candidates do other than those two things we mentioned?
My concern is that some of the exchanges between the candidates would be confusing to voters. So, for example, they're not necessarily not being truthful. It's that the exchanges are confusing. When the Democrats stress jobs lost and the Republicans stress jobs gained, they're both usually using numbers that are pretty close to being right, although the Democrats tend to feature private sector jobs lost, which would be a number that's inflated. When you put together public sector and private sector, you're going to get a much smaller number, about by a million. But the important question is, what is the net? After you've gained those jobs and you've lost jobs, are you ahead or behind? And in the debates, when you don't clarify that fact, the public can think that they're both lying, when in fact they're both selectively using the truth. We have had a net loss of jobs, but not as many as the Democrats suggest. There's also a lot of confusion about the claim about who raises taxes and who's voted to cut taxes. In one of the stranger exchanges across all of the debates, the Republicans allege that the senator has voted to increase taxes 98 times. Now, that's down from the 350 they used to claim and are still occasionally claiming in their ads. So the Democrats, in frustration, because that 98 number counts a lot of things that we reasonably wouldn't call votes for tax increases, such as procedural votes, or votes that didn't have the net effect of increasing taxes, or multiple votes that ultimately culminate in one vote, but that be counted multiple times. The Democrats, in frustration, have decided to use the same bogus method of counting to say that Senator Kerry has voted to cut taxes by 600 times. Now, if people aren't confused by that, I'm amazed. And if they take it literally, they might think that all Congress ever does is votes to increase or decrease taxes.
How does the media weigh these distortions and untruths in some cases? Do some exaggerations deserve more coverage than others?
The ones on which people are likely to vote are the things that are the most important. And so, now, occasionally there are small misstatements, and they're not really even worthy of focus. But if you're likely to cast your vote on how likely it is that Senator Kerry has in the past voted to increase taxes, then it's important to get a sense that that number is highly exaggerated. If you're likely to cast your vote based on how many jobs you think are lost, well, it's important to know what the net number is, and not to take just private sector, but also to include government jobs. So I worry most about those things that might forecast governance, might forecast a vote, where confusion might really matter.
Ron Elving, one thing that politicians always want to avoid in a high-profile event like this is the terrible mistake. We all remember, I guess, President Ford's premature liberation of Eastern Europe in a debate and when he was trying to get elected. There certainly didn't seem to be any gaffes on that order.
No, not in any of the four debates was there a moment when everyone had a sharp intake of breath, a gasp, and a reaction then to what in the world was he thinking, what in the world does he mean by that. We can all agree that's not true. In fact, there were many misstatements, many little errors, if you will, miscalculations, misrepresentations, most of which, I would say, fell within a rhetorical kind of context, stretching the facts to make a point, things of that nature. There were also, in many respects, failures, I would say, to present the facts or to present the viewpoint of one candidate or the other in the most effective way. And one wonders sometimes why they leave some things aside. As Kathleen was just saying about the the jobs numbers, why would it not be enough to say that after you count the ones created and the ones lost, you have this net number, and then, of course, proceed to the first president in 72 years not to produce an economy with more jobs? It just doesn't seem as though they're going at it in a way that would resolve the clash between the two competing numbers in their favor. Mm-hmm. Or in another instance, when Senator Kerry showed no interest whatsoever in criticizing the administration for the fact that we have only half the doses of flu vaccine that we were counting on this year. He had virtually nothing to say about that except to say that it illustrated a larger failure on health care.
But you do have an interesting moment there, because the president would have you believe that it was the United States that caught those defective vaccines, when in fact it was Britain. And there's a wonderful comment by a person who...
And apparently that lawyers were contaminating it.
And there's a wonderful moment by one of the focus group members on one of the networks who afterwards said something I thought was just fascinating. He said, why is it that in the last debate the president said he didn't want to trust drugs coming in from Canada that we're going to re-import? He was worried about their safety, but now he wants to go to Canada to get us more flu vaccines.
These are exactly the kinds of things that I think average listeners, watchers, people who are paying attention to the debate, catch themselves, throw their hands up and say, well, why didn't he say this? But that's not a gaffe. That may be a missed opportunity, or it may be, you know, an inability to quite think on their feet the way we sitting back on our chairs can do as sort of armchair quarterbacks. But still, there seem to be quite a number of those in the debates this year.
Let's get another caller on the line. Cheryl is with us from Braintree, Massachusetts.
Hi. This is kind of a comment and a question, and you actually touched upon it briefly. I was going to bring up my disappointment with all the missed opportunities that there were with all the debates. I felt I'm a Kerry supporter. You know, I'm a Democrat. I'm going to vote for Kerry, but I've been so disappointed in that, you know, he hasn't been able to bring his arguments down to a personal level. I feel like both candidates have been so focused on their canned responses. The issue with the flu shot was one I thought that Kerry just turned it around to a larger health care issue instead of addressing the problems with how we get drug companies to test drugs. And then the classic question about what do you say to somebody who's lost his job to, you know, overseas workers and you know, is on unemployment. Bush made it an education issue, which was completely off base. And Kerry touched upon a lot of the problems around that, but he completely missed the opportunity to say when somebody has a family and they lose their job, they don't always have the time to go back to school immediately. They need so many other things first. And in addition to the fact that that a lot of the jobs being lost are at a college level, Bill Clinton was somebody that I thought did this so well, and I think that's why he got elected twice. He could bring things down to a personal level, and I've been so disappointed with why John Kerry can't seem to do that. I just wondered if you could comment on that. Mm-hmm.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson?
One of the reasons that I like the town hall format, in particular the way it was used this year, in which the questions were screened, so unintelligible questions such as the one that trapped President Bush Sr. in 1992 just aren't asked. One of the reasons I like the format is that it lets the candidate see the face of the person who's raising the question. I think part of the problem for both of the candidates when someone says, speak to the worker, speak to the individual, is that the person asking the question is Bob Schieffer, and the candidate is looking into the camera or at Bob Schieffer or at a darkened audience, and it's difficult for the candidate and for the audience to imagine the person who is supposed to be addressed in that hypothetical. Where when you hear the question asked by the individual, and I thought in particular the question raised by the woman who was wondering why her tax money should be used to pay for abortion when she disapproves of abortion was one of those wonderful moments. I mean, there's an individual with a moral dilemma who is raising a serious question, and I thought it was a very revealing moment, in part because she was asking the question. It wasn't a hypothetical. So, yes, I think both candidates could do it better. I also think it's extremely difficult to do it in a format in which you're speaking from behind a podium to a moderator and largely an unseen audience. Right?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Cheryl. Let's turn now to Deborah. Deborah's calling from Berkeley, California.
Good morning. comment and then a question. I felt that Kerry actually came across very presidentially with gravitas, and some graciousness towards the president. I've been disappointed that Bush has resorted to slogans and attacks so much. In fact, what he used to say about Osama bin Laden, he's saying to Kerry now, he can run, but he can't hide. So I don't think he appeared very presidential. My question is about polling. I heard on PBS that many polls are focused at, quote, likely voters, meaning people who have voted before. And so my question is, how is the newly registered, not previously voting person being reflected? And I guess I have hope that many of them are registering to vote for Kerry.
Mm-hmm. Ron Elving?
That is a classic problem with the likely voter characterization. And this year it has led to many new questions being asked about the difference between registered voters and likely voters. And the controversies that have always surrounded polling on these issues have been intensified because many people, such as this caller, are aware of the higher rates of registration and the people who are more interested than ever before and showing every sign they plan to turn out. Those people are not as likely to be perfectly reflected in the polling science because they haven't been voters before and because they're just being brought in. Generally speaking, we expect new voters to vote mostly like people who have voted before, but there can be some differences at the margin, and in a close election like this, they could be terribly important.
Don't most polls this year, though, show that registered voters and likely voters break out pretty much the same way?
Yes, generally speaking, that's right. But if you do have some preponderance of Democrats, say a 3-2 advantage in a particular state, an important state in Ohio or Florida or Wisconsin, that could be a dispositive difference. But historically, we have not seen a lot of elections where suddenly a new flood of people got registered, and say, for example, when women first began to vote in the 1920s, or when young people first began to vote in the 1970s when the vote was lowered to 18. We have not seen an election where a sudden influx of the newly enfranchised radically changed the results, or radically changed the system.
Thanks for the call, Deborah.
Thanks.
Kathleen Hall Jameson, I wanted to ask you for a little historical perspective. I know you've looked at the 2000 debates and about the effect they had on the race. What did you find?
In the book, The 2000 Election and the Foundations of Party Politics, which I wrote with Richard Johnson and Michael Hagan, we show that in the last debate, the argument that Vice President Al Gore was making, that there would be a $1 trillion shortfall in the Bush Social Security proposal, an argument reprised last night by Senator Kerry, we found that the last debate began to lock that argument in with a portion of the electorate, which then got reinforcement from news in the last weeks of the campaign, where the Gore argument began to take hold effectively, but that the Bush campaign, by outspending on advertising, managed to blunt the effect in the battleground states, thereby producing an outcome in which the battleground states deadlocked effectively, and the popular vote went to Vice President Gore.
We're talking about last night's debates, this year's debates, and debates in general. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Henry. Henry's calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi.
Hi.
This is kind of a peripheral point, but I was just very surprised at the third debate at the manner and presentation that Kerry made. I was kind of expecting him to build on his, you know, strong performance in the first two debates, but he came across as very, at least in my view, very subdued, kind of tentative, almost depressed, or even bored with the situation. I don't know if other people saw it that way, but I was very surprised by that, and they almost struck me like Mutt and Jeff or something, because Bush really pushed the positive. I mean, he was smiling away, he looked very cheery, and it kind of, you know, rhymed with his message that things were on the right track. And I don't know, I felt Kerry kind of dropped the ball there. He seemed very tired. Maybe he'd had a long day, I don't know.
Well, that was the criticism of President Bush after the first debate. But Ron Elving, was that your impression?
No, I can't say that was my impression. I felt as though President Bush came out in the first 30 minutes of the debate very eager to be more likable, very eager to erase past impressions, particularly from the first debate. He did smile a great deal. I think in general it's a good idea to smile and to be a friendly candidate. The smiles were not always appropriate. The laughter was not always appropriate. And I thought once he got to the abortion issue and got more serious, that he then became more effective, calmed himself, and in the latter 60 minutes of the debate was more effective. I thought John Kerry last night, while there certainly were some moments of hesitation, some moments when he didn't speak, some moments when he started an answer with something other than a real word, he was emoting in a way and perhaps connecting with the viewer, the voter, looking into the camera, speaking, as it seemed, from the heart about things such as growing up a Catholic and then coming into some conflict with Catholic teachings, trying to work that out as a public figure, what he believed, what his religious faith meant to him in terms of his actions as a politician. I thought he seemed a bit more real than I'd ever seen him, and I've been watching him for 20 years here in Washington.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, let me end by asking you what you think we will remember from this year's presidential debates.
I think we'll remember that in a consequential time with a high level of voter anxiety, two candidates reassured the nation about their determination to defend it against terrorism, did not find clear differences on the plan to extricate the country from Iraq successfully, other than the argument that one person might be better as a person than the other given his history in the conflict. And I think we will also say that the campaign debates forecast a central domestic agenda item of each. If the president is reelected, Social Security reform is going to be on the table. If the senator is elected, we're going to have health care reform or a serious effort to produce it.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, as always, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Kathleen Hall Jamison is director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of many books on politics and advertising, including the 2000 presidential election and the foundations of party politics. And she was with us by phone from her office in Pennsylvania. Ron Elving, as always, we thank you for your presence here on Talk of the Nation.
My pleasure, Neil.
Ron Elving joined us here in Studio 3A. If you want to hear the full debate or read a transcript, just go to npr.org. When we come back from a short break, should there be a test of mental competence before people are allowed to vote? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.